Ken, thank you very much for agreeing. As I told him here, you and I had chatted earlier and said we'd keep today kind of short. The last one, my notes, we had spent a fair amount of time on the internal AFL versus CIO leadership conflicts in the area of auto manufacturing and auto parts supply.
Right.
And talked about some of the reasons why somebody like Gabe Jewell decided to go with the Homer Martin and then the other people with the UAW-AFL.
Right.
And we were then going to get to corruption and Tony Dorio and the relationship of some of the people that you knew even better, like Dominic D'Ambrosia.
Sure.
And his choices. But I had asked you just if there was any other reflections about Les Washburn that you had picked up that you remembered from interviewing Les or anything of that sort, because the voice library here has a lot of things that relate to Lansing Auto as part of their collections. And, of course, one of the things Les Washburn was famous for long before your involvement was the very beginning of UAW 182 and the Lansing Labor Holiday and Homer Martin's activity in relationship to that. So I didn't know if you had anything else you were going to
say about Les.
Well,
yeah, I was going through the transcript of the interview I had with him since we last talked, and without getting into too much detail, because it's all there and there's no reason in me trying to summarize it too much, other than to say that, you know, when we look at that particular interview, he talks, you know, a lot about, for instance, the establishment of Local 92 down in Niles.
Okay.
Which was at a place called Kawni, spelled K-A-W-N-I. And it had been largely organized by some of the guys out of Studebaker, which, of course, was just a few miles away.
Right.
And there, even though there was a clear majority for union representation, there was the issue there that the company totally refused to go ahead with recognizing the union and bargaining with them. And so Les went down there, apparently, as either still while he was still just a local union member, you know, officer rather, and worked with him. And of course the company was adamant, so they began a strike at Local 92, and then he got involved with the governor, who by then, I don't have his name, but he was a Republican who had replaced Frank Murphy, who had been governor. And then at first he went in to meet with the governor, as I take his interview. And the governor at first said, well, the law is brand new. We're talking about the National Labor Relations Act.
Right.
This would have been post 1935.
Well, if it's after Frank Murphy is only there for 2 years, so he's there for 37 and 38. So this must have been in 39 or 40.
Oh, this must have been much later then, yeah.
Because the sit-down runs 36, 37, and Murphy just takes office after the sit-down has started. I'm talking about the GM Flint sit-down.
Okay, right,
and
sure.
And Frank Murphy is the governor during 37 and 38, and then the election in November 38 you'd put, and I can't remember, Wagoner or which governor it was. I don't have that in front of me. But we do go back to Republican governor,
right,
which is what we mostly had until Soapy Williams in 48.
Right, and anyway,
So anyways, Washburn has
so
a meeting with him.
The governor at first was reluctant to, you know, in a sense, follow through on any support. But then apparently, as Les describes it, he finally realized, and he sent his representative down, and they met with the company, I guess, and then helped to bring an end to the strike. But anyway, he's got a number of examples of incidents like that over at Continental Motors, which he says was at Muskegon then. It was there. Okay.
Yeah, that's where it was. The main, there was a Detroit Continental, but the main one that lasts a lot longer is the Muskegon Continental Motors.
Okay, all righty. And he's got incidents there, so you really need to go through that that interview. What? It's a little, you know, Les goes a little all over the place, so you have to, you know, have to go into it. And then there'd have to be independent research. For instance, you'd go down and we'd look at the Niles newspaper, because there was a daily there at that time. I don't know if there still is.
I have some footage. I don't remember if I've ever shown you or not, but I got it from one of the previous regional directors of some activity, like the opening of the 182 hall,
right,
which was a big deal, and also some footage, some might have been of the labor holiday. I haven't been able to verify that. Some of it clearly is the same year that you're talking here, or maybe into the war, of some strikes in different towns, Albion and so on and so forth, that the region was involved.
Right, and I saw that footage many years ago. We must have shown it at a Region 7 conference.
I would assume so. And for the record, Les Washburn's elected, according to his obit that I pulled up for this, he was elected director of the UAW-AFL's Western Michigan Region 7 in 36, and stayed that until he became president of the union in 43, if the obit's correct.
That is correct, yes.
So he, and then stayed as international president until 54.
Correct.
So what was the year again when you did the interview with him?
Oh, let's see, I got it right here. Where the hell I just had to... It's a folder. I just had it in front of me.
Oh, that's okay.
There it is. I got it. I was doing some other work while I was waiting for your call. I did that in 1986 and
okay.
1988. There was May of 1986 and then May of 1988.
And there's a transcript. One of the things about the voice library is to actually get the audio. We don't have the audio in your possession, my possession, or anyone's here, or what? Where do we stand on that?
Well, as I recall, Lisa said that I'd have to go back and reconstruct. I'm not sure. But she had it. She gave it to somebody.
At MSU.
Yeah, right. And it's in your system there somewhere.
Okay, so I don't think it's this part of the university, but I'll have to try to figure that out. So, okay,
yeah.
But anyway,
that's it. There was something else. You know, I did a history of the union on its 50th anniversary.
Maybe. Right, I have that with me actually.
Yeah, and if you will notice, there's a picture on the front page of that, of the first National Council meeting of the federal labor unions in the auto industry at the Hoffman Building in 1934.
In downtown Detroit, I think Woodward Avenue.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and that kind of dates, helps, you know, date that,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, really early part of it. But what I have done, which I will copy. I promised I would do it, and I didn't. You do have the Gabe Jewell video.
I have three VHSs.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I do have my written hand notes, which I listened to the whole thing, I believe, and put down the times when various items show up.
And you said you'd send me those.
Yeah, right.
Now, I have the transcript of your interview by Professor Gordon.
Yes, right.
But I don't have the transcript of your Washburn interview.
Well, that I've got a copy because I'm presuming Lisa's got the PDF of it. But it's about 70 pages too, so I'll just have to run it through and get it.
I'm sorry, but that would be very helpful.
I'll have to get it.
And I will work on trying to find where the audio is.
Yeah. Because, it's kind of key, and I think Gabe's, rather than me trying to relate that whole thing, I think it's best you just go through that video interview. You can do that more at your leisure,
No problem.
Sure.
Just before we leave with Les, I asked you a couple times the last session, what was your thoughts on why some of these, I guess it was mostly men at that point, decided to stay with what was turning out to be the smaller UAW union?
Well, I think part of it, I think the, really major portion of it was the connections that they had with various leaders within the various areas of the country. In other words, if a local leader was for instance, George Keebler over here in Milwaukee, and I believe he came out of Old Seaman Body, which was becoming part of Nash, which eventually became UAW Local 75 in the CIO side, of course. And George was a very competent, guy. And, I think that kind of, leadership showed off, eventually. So my guess is that, people trusted him.
Uh-huh.
And so he had a lot of support. And, so I think that was typical. You get into areas like Western Michigan, where you had Ed Donahue early on, and you had the leadership of Local 182 with Les Washburn. Now Les was very concerned in reviewing his interview, as was Gabe, with the so-called communist faction that they believed was steering the activities out of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And Homer Martin at that time, during when the split occurred, even teamed up with people like Father Coughlin, who was posing as a great anti-communist. He was an early collared Joe McCarthyite, of course.
Right.
And so they had some of those anti-communist fears that were cropping up everywhere, during the 30s and 40s. Just a quick aside, if you get a chance, go see the movie Trumbo, if you haven't seen it.
I haven't yet. Okay.
Yeah. And that, really sets the whole scene. There was very strong feelings at that time. A lot of it fueled by the Catholic Church, of course. And yet you had these very strong labor priests and a strong social justice portion of the church. And then you had the other charlatans that always show up in these debates.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I think it was both a desire to, you know, distance themselves, since the, you know, the Reuther brothers and their cohorts had been, you know, castigated as communists. They had spent some time in Moscow, of course, in their early years, and all that sort of, you know, stuff. And I'm just stating this factually. I'm not.
Right.
It's not reflecting my own personal bias.
No, I understand.
And so I think they feared that. And then, of course, there were these strong leaders in various parts of the country. A guy by the name of Pete Noel, down in Cincinnati, and later Morris Weintraub, and eventually Dominic. But all those guys, you know. So the locals stayed there. They were comfortable with them.
So a lot of it's personalities, who people had worked with, who they had gone through struggles with, who they came to trust as fellow trade unionists.
That's my view of it. Of course, I was 10 and 11 years old at that time.
No, but so. but when you arrived, again, for my recollection, what year do you arrive working for the union?
Not till 1968.
68. But in 68, you still have people like regional, former or current regional directors, Michigan ones like Donahue, or former ones like Glass, or working with Dominic or others from these other places, telling you stuff as you're the newer guy in the staff.
Surely.
And so those were the stories you picked up from those gentlemen.
Right. And, you know, I mean, when we get into the Reform Convention of 57, I worked directly for Carl, you know, Griebentrog and Dominic D'Ambrosio, who were very much a part of it. And, you know, so, and then, of course, you because that only happened 11 years before I got on staff. And I had done some peripheral coverage of the union during the late 50s and early 60s as a reporter for the Milwaukee Sentinel, who covered labor on a part-time basis.
So you got to know some of these people while you were a reporter?
Yeah, not Carl but I knew Carl's successor as Region 9 director, who was Cliff Matchie. And
is that part of the reason you got hired by the International?
No, no.
The
whole reason I got hired, we had had a newspaper guild strike in 1962, and I was on the bargaining committee, and as you know, the Milwaukee Sentinel, which was a Hearst paper, was sold after 10 weeks of strike to the Milwaukee Journal. And then when the Journal began publishing, because we had actually shut the paper down solidly for 10 weeks. I was strike chairman. It's one of my proudest achievements. We shut the suckers down.
Okay.
But anyway, I mean, I didn't do it alone, obviously, but I was chairman of the strike committee and organized the mass picketing and all that other crap, you know. I was a little mild-mannered me. But anyway.
So it was your activity in the 62 newspaper guild strike that made that stronger connection for you?
Well, yeah, because I had become respected,
right.
I guess, or known to the AFL-CIO leadership in the area,
mm-hmm.
as a reporter and then as a leader of this strike. So,
but you had met some of these gentlemen before,
oh, yes.
as a reporter,
yeah,
in the 50s.
And I covered the merger convention when the state CIO and the state AFL emerged in, I believe, 58.
Ours was also later here.
Yeah. No, there was a lot of negotiations going on to who was going to do what, and they ended up, you know, even though the CIO group was a bigger group, they made the AFL guy president and the CIO guy secretary treasurer, you know. So there was those hard feelings. And then I went to work for 4 years as a regional representative, staff representative for District Council 48 of the American Federation of State and Municipal Employees. And then, of course, I got to know a lot of the guys. I even got into jurisdictional fights when we were organizing on the docks here in Milwaukee with the operating engineers who were operating the heavy equipment, who wanted to have jurisdiction on the heavy lift cranes and so forth.
Were these public employees? Is that why AFSCME was involved?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
They were their trade.
Well, right, exactly. And I forget what, I forget how we resolved that. And then later on, I get real buddy with these guys later on when I'm a rep when I joined AIW, you know. But that's all part of life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. So you want to switch over to talking about the corruption stories?
Sure, that'll be fine. And that all developed. And I've got to go back and research. The person that was involved, and it would be Irwin Carey, who was out of Kansas City local, was the president that succeeded Homer Martin in 19-whatever year I said that was. And he was succeeded by Les in 1943 And I think it was in 43 also that Anthony Doria, D-O-R-I-A, became Secretary Treasurer. Now, Tony was out of Local 232, which represented the Briggs and Stratton workers here in Milwaukee, which at that time was growing to be a very large firm. And, of course, I was most renowned for its lawnmower motors and snowblower motors and so forth.
had they had difficult contest with the UAW CIO for that, or
no? That was always that, as I recall, was very strong AFL all of the way through.
Okay,
and because Cliff Maggi, who later became regional director, was out of that local, they had a lot of strong leadership there. And, Tony was a very competent guy. There was no question about that.
Competent in bargaining or organizing?
He was a natural born leader.
Okay.
And that means that includes the whole ball game. And of course, sometimes guys get some power into what they're doing, and it goes to their head. But
is that Region 8?
Nine, excuse me.
Nine, okay, thank you.
That was Wisconsin and Minnesota and North and South Dakota.
Right.
And North and the Chicago area. But they had created created a district 10 out of Chicago. They carved it away from Region 9 somewhere during the early 40s and created a region where a guy by the name of Angelo Inciso, I-N-C-I-S-O, was made regional director. Now, Tony Doria believed that we could have great strength in creating amalgamated locals around, where we could organize a bunch of smaller industries and, you know, create kind of a local fiefdom, so to speak, or council through an amalgamated. It had been successful, of course, at 182 in, you know, Michigan.
Right.
And it had been also been fairly successful for old local 243 in Cleveland. But in both cases, those kind of became a little pockets of, you know, kind of maybe minor corruption.
Is that where Nick
Nick Seraglio,
comes out of that Cleveland amalgamated, right?
Right. And then there was a 287, I believe, in Youngstown. And so...
387.
Was it 387?
Charles Street, 387.
Yeah, Charlie, yeah.
I'm looking at a convention roll call, that's why I know that.
Yeah, I'm not sure Charlie... Well, I don't think Charlie was particularly corrupt. I don't know the whole story about 387.
Uh-huh.
But Carl Schmiegel and Frank Evans, who had in 1939, in an appeal to the black, you know, I think I related this in the past. Frank, who was out of Cleveland, was made Negro vice president on the executive board of the International, which was a position he held. So Frank was a big, tall, good-looking guy and garrulous and great to be around, you know, just a fun guy to be with, you know.
This is Frank Evans out of Cleveland.
Out of Cleveland.
Local 336, it says, okay.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know if you ever worked in that plant.
Uh-huh.
that became semi-corrupt, too.
Okay.
At least in my, I don't have any direct knowledge. I'm dirtying the names of people who I can't prove.
Now, these, because of the regional directors pushing it, or people in the president or secretary treasurer office, or both?
Well, I mean, Tony encouraged these amalgamated.
Okay.
And it was one of the things that when we reformed the union after 57 that they tried to get away from was the amalgamated, you know, for just the kind of corruption that came up. And what Angelo came up with in Chicago was an insurance scheme, which I don't have the details of, but that was the thing that got him into trouble. And that was, you know, and so that was when they started mixing the insurance money with the union dues money.
Uh-huh.
And so...
Was that voluntary insurance money, or was this money that they had negotiated with employers, or...
I don't honestly know.
That's okay.
We have to go into that into that detail. But my guess is that it was, you know, it was a way to skim off some cash for the leadership, and,
right?
And maybe for the union, you know. So, and a lot of it, you know, I think they tried to work out sweetheart deals with, you know, some of these employers, and I wouldn't doubt that they didn't use some strong arm extortion type activities. After all, this was Chicago, you know.
Gotcha.
And I don't think that stuff ever happened up in Milwaukee, for instance, and, you know, most of the union. Because we had a very strong group down in Local 95 at the big GM plant in Janesville. Of course, they went CIO after the election of 41. But anyway, there was a dispute on the board at that time because they wanted to revoke the charter for the for the amalgamated. They got into a big dispute on that. And then the other part of the corruption that came up was that Doria and those were working with Johnny Diogardo, and that this is in the files, also known as Johnny Dio,
right,
in New York City, to organize the cab drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And they claimed at one time that Dio was supposedly using extortion and threats to get cabbies to, you know, join up. And, I mean, Doria saw, from the union point of view, 10,000 easy members, you know.
Right.
And Lord knows, with, you know, New York City and its crime element at that time, you know, who knew, you know, where that would go.
So
all that activity got into the McClellan Committee in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
That's all in the testimony of that committee. You got a thick volume of that testimony that was for that. Early, prior to all the investigation getting in there, Les Washburn at this time claimed that he was fighting against these guys, tried to get them to revoke the charter down in Chicago and also Johnny Dio's charter. And Doria was able to, as I recall now, and have to go back and check the records, to convince the board to vote against Washburn's desire, and that's when Washburn resigned in 1954. Gabe Jewell has criticized Washburn for not fighting strongly enough against the corruption within his thing, that, you know, Les was a dedicated, nice guy, but not strong enough to, you know, fight back against these guys. And that may be true, you know, because sometimes if you're not inclined to be a backstabber and a power-hungry guy, which I don't think Les was, you know. I mean, he was content when he mm-hmm. retired to come to Wisconsin and open up a resort up in Tomahawk. But so anyway, my very good friend Ray Taylor, who was president, who was the editor of the UAW Auto Worker during this whole period under when they moved to Milwaukee in 1943, I believe it was, and he became editor of the international newspaper. And Ray stayed with them until 1954, when they moved to Los Angeles, and then took over as editor of the Milwaukee Labor Press, which he ran for years up until his retirement. And Ray was kind of an interesting guy in his own mind. Just a quick aside.
Yeah.
After he left the Labor Press, he became editor of the Wisconsin Teamster, which was kind of it was a once-a-month publication, but he had an office in the old Labor Press, building. And he and I, used to share, bullshit, because in a sense I took over his job in 1948 when I was hired by the AIW, which was putting out the international paper. And he says, here's a list. He had a typewritten list of perhaps 35 women. He says he claimed to have screwed every one of them, including some very prominent names in the city and so forth. So
mm-hmm.
whether he did or not, I don't know. he was a father with four kids and a loving wife, so I don't know what the hell went on there.
Who is this you're talking about?
Ray Taylor.
Oh, this is on Ray. Okay.
Yeah. Just, he was notorious.
So,
But anyway, Ray tells a story, as does Gabe Jewell, of meeting with Doria and the guys in New York City and being taken into a club, an Italian club, you know, restaurant and so forth, like they had in those days. And the showgirls were called out and joined them at the table and all that sort of stuff to try get the board not to revoke the charter, you know.
Right.
So anyway, that's an aside.
Well, a lot of so one of several books that has a little on this was one by John Hutchinson.
Uh-huh.
Was done way back in 72, The Imperfect Union, History of Corruption in American Unions. And there are only a few pages, but page 312 through 316 is about exactly this story.
Yeah.
And it talks about Washburn meeting with Meany to talk about this business, and then things that Dio do and Dorio do, and subsequent meetings, and the fact that the AFL-CIO finds that there's no question that stuff that Enciso did, they said, was shocking, and that things weren't in dispute. Stuff you're talking about, and then other, you know, specifics about amount of dollars and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's all in there, and what you got in both Les's transcripts and Jules and a little bit in Dom's are this story told from their firsthand view of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, and Tony resigned, I suppose, in about 1950. Well, then they moved to Los Angeles, you know,
right.
1954. And that was very controversial. And then to make matters worse, they moved to Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just the address was bad enough. And I mean, they bought a really great building out there, and I think it was the old Capitol Records first building, which was, you know, and they furnished it first class. In fact, when they moved back to Milwaukee in 58 or 59, they moved all that furniture back, and was in our office, and, you know, we were using it, and it was great furniture, you know, so. But anyway.
But
Tony, so that went on, and then we had the special convention, and then there was a lot of infighting there as to who would be the international presidents and all that sort of stuff.
So, in the book that I was reading from, it talked about that by the fall of 57, the AFL-CIO terminates the probationary status and while staying in a monitorship, they called it, they pretty much are welcoming back the AIW, saying you cleaned up. What did you learn from those three guys in terms of how did they clean things up within a year, whereas in other unions like the Teamsters and the textile workers and some others, the union wasn't able to do that internally at all?
Well, first of all, you did have, I mean, the majority of the union, I mean, just about everybody who was a rank-and-file officer and most of the regional directors, and, you know, they were totally clean and dedicated unionists. They all came out of the 30s, you know, and all had that, you know, still that old spirit, and they did not want to leave the new AFL-CIO at that time. They wanted to stay in the House of Labor. They were too small a union to snub their noses at the AFL-CIO for its actions, you know, as the Teamsters were able to do. And so you had these dedicated guys, and the regional directors on the board who really wanted to get rid of that stain. You know, they had originally been, in a sense, conned by Tony Doria because he was such a leader. You know, he was, he took charge, and they probably early on respected him. But then, of course, then you had people, as I said earlier, by then it was Morris Weintraub in Region 4 at Cincinnati, Ed Donahue in Region 7, Carl Grieventrog in Region 9, and so you had these guys who were very strong leaders within their region and had the majority of the members, except for Region 8, where Jewel came out of, and there was some sympathy for Tony Doria. Gabe always admired Doria's skills, you know, I mean, without supporting what he did.
Right.
And that was certainly part of it. So they, you know, basically took control of that convention. The AFL-CIO assigned a guy by name of Pete McGavin to be the monitor and to convene the convention, as I recall. And, you know, and the other thing the AFL-CIO said, that the entire executive board had to resign, and some of them, the top officers, could not stay on. So that, but by then Earl Heaton resigned at that point, who was president, and Gabe Jewell took a little persuasion to keep him on, because he came on when Doria resigned. But Gabe's hands were pretty clean, you know. And so he was able to stay on. And then, of course, they had to hold a whole new election. And in each of the regions. And you know, basically, the good guys won all the way through. I don't think we ever did totally clean house in Cleveland. But the guy that took over had not been there before. So, you know, they met the AFL-CIO guidelines. And so they were successful, and 5 months later, they returned the charter. And so we were able to, you know, move on from there. But it was the work, you know, and there were some internal disputes at that convention as to who would be the leadership, and both Dom and Gabe were engaged in that thing, and Jewel eventually agreed because he had power, as did Carl Grieventrog have a power, and it was brokered a little bit with Ed Donahue and Morris Weintraub from, you know, Cincinnati, so that eventually Gabe claimed he agreed that Carl could become president and he'd become secretary treasurer. And so that's what occurred. They avoided that kind of a internecine battle. And
It's pretty impressive that this all takes place within just a couple of years.
Exactly, right. Well, I mean, the stain on the union was, you know, really pretty bad. And these guys, you know, something they had all worked on through the years, had fought with the CIO for, you know, folks plus management, you know, and to kind of throw that down the hill, and they would have been at the mercy for raids from the AFL-CIO unions, and because we didn't have a clean charter in a sense like the mine mill and smelters and some of those unions that were kicked out for either communist or corruption reasons.
What kind of charter didn't you have? Would you repeat what you're saying?
Well, I was saying we didn't have kind of a specialty charter. I mean, we were representing all types of industrial workers. So,
okay.
If, you know, for instance, in Fort Wayne, we had Magnavox, and we had Dana, and we had, in other words, we were in auto parts, we were in electronics, we were, so the UE, in fact, we fought with the UE. We did our union, frankly, in the late 40s when the UE was being tagged with being a communist union. That was one of the more shameful chapters because we went in and, in a sense, you know, raided them and took over that large Magnavox local. So,
is that something you want to talk about another time or not in terms of
relations? No, I don't know too much about that.
Not that specific, but I mean relations with other international unions in the 50s and 60s.
Sure, I know a little bit about that.
Okay.
Of course, by the time I got involved, and I did a lot of organizing after 68 when I got there, even though I was editor and political action director, because a small union, you got involved in everything, you know. Which was kind of fun, but
So next time relations with other unions, relations with state AFL, with state feds, and the national AFL, and we were going to talk about next time coordinated bargaining a little. And
I'll have to get a hold of. I don't have any of the files here from those days. That's the problem.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know what else, you know, I can tell
you. What you do remember, we talked a little bit about health and safety.
Sure.
Efforts in terms of discrimination and advancement of African-American workers.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did a lot of things in that, and it was mainly in the through the education area and tried to be the best damn union in the world, and I mean that honestly in the sense of trying to further the principles of trade unions in the best possible traditions, but we didn't succeed as well as we'd like, of course.
So let's talk about that the next time.
Sure.
And then after that, maybe the last in this series, we can talk about deindustrialization, the 80s, and the mergers into PACE and so forth.
Surely.
Does that make sense?
Sure. When do we schedule next? I don't have my calendar.
Well, I got to bring mine up. But I can do that.
Well, don't worry about it.
Well, it's not hard. It should. I think we've been doing these every 2 weeks or so.
Yeah, it would be the 2 weeks from now would be the. This is the 8th, so it'd be the 22nd, just before Christmas.
And if that's still okay, that's where I have it, at 10 o'clock I time, 9 o'clock your time on the 22nd.
Shouldn't be an issue.
We can change it if it is.
If something comes up with our families because of the Christmas season, feel free to change it, okay?
Okay. On the corruption and those stories, for people like Dominic, who comes in at the sort of end and then is there to kind of put it back together, or some of the people like Walter Campbell here in this area, or Ed Donahue here, How embarrassing, how difficult were these corruption things, do you think, by the time we get to the 60s and later?
Well, it was brought up periodically in organizing drives. And unfortunately, it wasn't always brought up by the management. It sometimes was brought up by the opposing union, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so that became an issue. But by the time I got on board, that rarely came up. But it was there. And if you got into a tight fight, somebody would go down and, you know, pick up, go into the files and find, oh, this is the, and, you know, then they'd have comments from Robert Kennedy. Nobody in our union leadership loved Bobby Kennedy because he was chief counsel, as you recall,
right,
for the McClellan Commission.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Did people, do you think some of these leaders from that generation, the people you worked for, how do you think they felt about the Teamsters and Hoffa and that sort of business?
Well, I think there was some admiration for Hoffa just because of his of the strength and the power that he displayed, you know. And I mean, there was Gabe loved power.
Okay.
I don't mean so much in the sense that he exercised dictatorial power or anything, but he liked the symbol of people with power. Now, he would be too smart, of course, to have supported somebody now like Donald Trump. But that kind of a guy who, you know, speaks straight out and exudes power. So that was always admired by a lot of, you know, labor guys. And, of course, I didn't like the results, but, yeah.
Did they have unique relationships? I mean, I assume the Teamsters were of influence in some of the cities where AIW was strong, and they were independent. Has that become much of a story or not really?
No.
Okay.
No. At least it didn't in Milwaukee, where I had personal... Teamsters with Frank... Well, we tried to... The AFL-CIO and Frank Rainey, who was head of Teamsters Local 200, which was a statewide local here... did some maintain peace, let's say that way.
Uh-huh.
I think there was kind of a sweetheart deal between them all not to step on each other's toes. But there wasn't a lot of intercourse or interaction, I should say,
mm-hmm.
between the Teamsters. Now, ironically, the huge Teamsters 200 Hall is located at 6200 West Blue Mountain Road, and the AFL State CIO headquarters is at 6333 West Blue Mountain Road. They're just a block and a half apart.
Okay. Two more last questions. So corruption got used against the people in that generation before you, against the UAW, AFL, and then AIW. To what extent was the response, many of you CIOs are communist-dominated?
Oh, I think that was pretty well dissipated by that time. Yeah, we were getting into the civil rights fight and the anti-war movement and all that, which... brings up another era of of labor union involvement when we get into the anti-war fights.
I'll write that down as another thing to talk about.
Of the 60s, that I was very much involved.
Okay, because you get a lot of dispute within labor about what side to take and changes.
Oh, yeah.
We can do that. I was remiss in not asking you... what discussion was there? What other choices about a new name once you were going to not be able to be the UAW-AFL after AFL-CIO merger?
Well, there was a lot of discussion there. There was the question of whether or not to lose our identity. But part of the merger agreement, I don't know where that would have come up, but it was pretty much the AFL-CIO wanted us to change their name. And I mean, I thought the Allied Industrial Workers name was a very fitting name, and I always felt that if, and I know Dom felt this way too, he couldn't pull it off, that we were the natural repository of all these smaller unions, like the, you know, molders in Cincinnati and the brewery workers necessarily, you know, who eventually went to UAW and the UE, actually. We talked with them about mergers for a while, and we had a merger with the molders, but it was voted down at the convention.
I remember that. That was in my time.
Yeah, right. So on and so forth. So, I mean, I thought we had the perfect name for becoming kind of the catalyst for all these smaller independent unions.
I don't recall whose idea was the name AIW.
I have no idea.
Okay, fine. So I still need to send you a copyright permission form. Apparently I didn't do that yet, but I will get around to doing that.
And I will try to find time to make you copies and in a PDF format and send.
Okay, and I will try to see if I can figure out where at MSU there might be the actual recording that you did on probably cassette tape back then.
Oh, yes, yeah. Uh-huh.
So thank you very much for today.
Okay, well, and go Spartans, I guess. Huh?
It's been pretty interesting.
I tell you, that final drive Saturday night was truly impressive.
It really was.
I mean,
it was
did
a little.
Pass at all?
Yes, actually, there were a couple passes.
Yeah, yes, I know there were.
But obviously, our quarterback was ailing. And they didn't want to rely on him too much, but they still used him for a run, and he's not a running quarterback.
Yeah, right.
On that very key fourth down play, which if it had failed, it would have been over.
Exactly.
It was quite amazing, and it's the stories here in Michigan are all focused in on the success of the Spartans this year, and what a unique story it's been. So it's a lot of fun here.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, enjoy.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care.
Eric, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.